It's time to take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, back with us. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. And we'll talk with him about, a lot of things. Maybe the DNR's first new wolf management plan in 25 years. We'll take a look at the lives of animals during the winter months. What do you want to know about the wolf plan? Maybe you need some help picking out gifts for the outdoorsy person in your life. What are your questions about wildlife? You can join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry and listeners. It's great to be back on.
Tell you what, we've got animals getting ready for winter, and some of them have some pretty amazing ways to survive the coldest months. I was talking about frogs in my introduction to the show, frogs that freeze. Talk about some of the animals with impressive winter survival methods.
Well, there are three basic strategies that animals use to get through our winter months. I mean, they've adapted over the many years of evolution to fit in with Wisconsin winters, just like something else I want to talk about later, which is the impact of the Florida hurricanes on wildlife down there. But in any event, the strategies that our wildlife use are not unlike the strategies that our fellow humans use as when winter comes around. I mean, there are three basic alternatives. You either leave, in other words, migrate, which is the strategy our snowbirds use as they move down to their Florida and Gulf Coast residences for the winter. And that, of course, is dominated by many birds that migrate out. But there are a couple of bat species that migrate as well. So one strategy is get the heck out of here. Second strategy is to avoid winter weather period in place by hibernating. Whether it's a frog in the muck of the bottom of a swamp along with the turtles, or whether it's a bear in its den, we can get into the issues of true hibernation versus dormancy later, but that's a technical point. The point is whether it's true physiological hibernation or some form of dormancy, a number of different animals, particularly reptiles and amphibians, but also a few mammals, simply avoid winter by getting out of the way, so to speak. And the third strategy is to simply alter behavior. That's what most of us do. We can't go to Florida for the winter, and we certainly can't crawl down into a hole in the ground and just avoid the whole thing. So we change our behavior. In our case, we put on a down parka. In the case of animals, they grow thicker, more dense fur. We change our behaviors. We don't go outside very much. And for some of our middle-sized animals that you see readily in the warmer season, skunks, possums, raccoons, things like that, those animals simply avoid the worst stretches of winter weather by staying in a tree den, hole in the ground, or whatever until conditions moderate. So there are behavioral changes in terms of activity and how they protect themselves, maybe changes in diet that are forced on them by the weather. But one way or the other, it's either get the heck out, hibernate, or change the way you do business, and you'll get through the winter just fine, like most of us do. We may not like it, and I can only imagine what a deer standing out on the back of my property here when it's snowing and blowing is thinking, if they're thinking about anything. But the issue is those strategies work.
They do indeed. I saw a little news item last night, I think it was. There's a bear that's in out east in Connecticut, maybe, that's hibernating in a tree, in a sort of a big cavity within the tree itself, but has been in there for about 3 weeks in front of somebody's lawn.
Yeah, it was the photographs were pretty cool. I mean, the bear was just kind of huddled up there in this giant tree cavity, peering out, and whether he was really ready for winter sleep or not, at least he was using that cavity. And I think part of the broadcast said there had been an uptick in bear human interactions in that area. So the bear may be living there, but whether he's settled down for the winter or not is another matter.
Oh, man. Kay on Prairie du Sac has something that may relate to all this. Let's go there. Hi, Kay.
I see on the news when a backcountry skier might get caught in an avalanche, how quickly they search for them. And I got to wondering about how do animals survive under the 6 feet of snow in Buffalo? And that includes turkeys that, you know, maybe couldn't fly up into a tree. And do they get, you know, did a lot of smaller animals not get enough air?
Yeah.
Well, Snow is surprisingly porous. There's a lot of air in snow. Ice is a lot worse and causes all sorts of problems for animals not being able to get through it, either from the ground up or the surface down to find food or get to shelter. But as far as snow is concerned, it's a terrific insulator. I mean, think about the native peoples of the far north living in an igloo or cutting an igloo or snow shelter out, or think back to when you were a kid and you took the snow shovel out of the garage and dug a big cavity in the snowplow pile that had been piled up, and holy cow, it was pretty comfortable in there, almost warm with a little bit of body heat. So some of our animals take advantage of that. Rough grouse, for example, dive or burrow into the soft snow to actually roost under the snow. I mean, they're trying to get down there. And many of our small mammals, like the voles and things that are active all winter and do some damage to our vegetation and so forth under the snow, that's when they cause most of their problems. They're doing just fine at ground level with a blanket of snow over them. And that blanket of snow not only keeps them relatively sheltered from the elements, but it also means no passing red-tailed hawk or other potential predator can get at them. That's why you see, for example, videos of foxes mousing in deep snow where they're listening and they can hear that mouse or vole under the snow. And then they leap up the air and pounce down, driving their snout and paws into the snow to try and get dinner. You know, those animals are doing just fine under the snow. So,
yeah,
an avalanche certainly probably could, you know, take out large animals in its path, like an elk, for example, on a mountain hillside. But for the most part, they're capable of not only avoiding it, but digging out of it. But the key really is to use that snow to their advantage as insulation and cover.
Kay, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Another, I think, related questions. Cater and Herbster, will go to you. Thank you for calling.
Hey, I'm a grouse hunter, and I've wondered this for years. What do birds, I mean, I think about grouse, but what do any birds that live far away from roads or other sources of grit, how do they find grit when it's a deep snow for a long time in the winter?
Interesting question. Not one I've ever thought about because, you know, usually while they may be a ways from a road, the road network is pretty extensive these days, and they don't need to get to a road very often to pick up some grit that way. But there are also windswept areas, south-facing spots where the sun, you know, manages to reach the soil, stream banks, spring seeps, and other areas where I think they can probably find enough and keep that. I mean, it persists in their crops for quite a while. I guess I have to offer up, I've never heard of that as a problem for these animals or a source of mortality or poor condition or whatever. So somehow at some of those other sources or occasional passage near a roadside where they could get grit or gravel from the roadside seems to be enough.
That's about
all I can offer up. They seem to be doing just fine. And maybe when a grouse is in a snow roost and they're close to the soil surface, they find a little that way, too. I don't know.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Robert, in Stevens Point, on to you now. Hi, Robert.
Hello. My question is, what do we know or the science tells us right now about mountain lions or cougars in the state of Wisconsin?
Okay.
That's an interesting one, and it's funny you should bring that up. I mean, this was one of the most common questions we used to get, as you recall, Larry,
yeah.
on shows back in the 90s and early 2000s. And then there were a couple of well-documented cougars, one in southern Wisconsin, one up in the northwestern part of the state, I think, where they were actually able to obtain blood samples, urine samples, hair samples, and documented that, A, yeah, it's a cougar, and B, the origin, when they could do some genetic work, was, again, where we had expected they were coming from as they moved through, which was out in the Dakotas, in the Black Hills and so forth. So the interesting part to me is that although I'm a little bit out of the loop in retirement, I try and keep up with the news sources and whatnot, and the world of the cougar situation seems to have been surprisingly quiet the last few years. Have you heard anything, Larry?
No, I haven't heard anything of sightings of cougars. And, you know, with all the trail cams out there, you'd think we would have, if there was one out there passing through, you'd think it would be found on one of those cameras.
Well, and maybe somebody working with the Snapshot Project can speak to that from the thousands and thousands of images they have. But the bottom line for Robert is that there were some well-documented cases that put to rest the fact that, or put to rest the debate that, no, there are no cougars. Well, yes, there are cougars. But I don't believe that there still is any evidence that the animals are reproducing in Wisconsin or really have set up any kind of a stronghold or degree of permanency. Most of the animals we've seen in the state over the years were passing through and ending up in places, in some cases, far to the east of us. They can cover a lot of ground. But I just haven't heard of many sightings lately, and maybe that's because once people realize, hey, this wasn't groundbreaking news anymore, maybe things have backed off a little bit. But we've got a big army of listeners out there, Larry. We'll see who's been seeing cougars lately and who hasn't.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure of that. And a cougar was captured on I'm getting this note from Clara, I believe. A cougar was captured on a trail camera the early morning of September 9th of this year near Cassville. And it was later verified by a local biologist. So I guess there was one. That was from the DNR. So I guess there was one.
Okay.
Passing
well,
through, probably.
If there's one, I suspect there's more. We'll see who calls in here for the rest of our time together.
But trail cams came up, and Dave from Cambria emailed us. I don't know if you saw the photo. It was part of a little movie from his game camera from this spring.
I saw it.
A trio of Jakes scaring off a fox.
Well, you know, I just had the one image as opposed to a video, which might have shown the idea that the animals were interacting. But the three Jakes were just kind of standing around on the far side of a water feature, a small pond. There was a deer stand in the background in the trees, and then the fox was in the foreground moving off to the right of the image and away from the turkeys. But it was unclear, whether it had been closer to the turkeys, whether it approached the turkeys, whether the turkeys approached it. But, three good-sized Jakes are a formidable 3-to-1 position. If the fox wasn't desperate for a meal, I think it would have given the turkeys a wide berth no matter what. But whether there was any real interaction of them that, they made a move toward it or it was making a move away from them as opposed to just leaving the area after getting a drink or whatever, I have no way of telling.
Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, as we talk the world of wildlife with Scott. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Lee Rayburn, our engineer today, Clara Neipert, our producer. I'm Larry Mailer for the Ideas Network. If you have a wildlife question, I hope you'll join in or maybe an experience to share. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@WPR.org. Let's take another call. Don in Bayfield County, thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. I live in Bayfield County, the town of Iron River. And Sunday morning, I saw deer tracks and cougar tracks were following the deer.
And you're sure they were cougar tracks?
Yes, I had a friend come over. I've got a book on footprints and the tail. You could see the tail dragging through the snow. And they were really big tracks.
Oh,
well, sounds like that's cougar report number two, Larry. We'll keep track here for the next hour and 20 minutes and see what we get. But that's a cool observation. The tracks are pretty distinctive, as are the tail marks. And how much snow do you have up there anyway, Don?
There's about a foot. And the last time I saw coyote tracks is about 5 years ago.
I was just curious about what we'll, as we're talking about wildlife and winter and a couple other things that will come up here, like the deer season report. I was wondering how much snow was on the ground up there, because we've got nothing down here, which is okay with me.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, anyway, that's a good sighting. I'm sure the cougar's interest in the deer wasn't necessarily friendship and holiday greeting, but we'll never know what happened.
Thanks, Don. Appreciate it. David in Park Falls. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, cougar just west of Park Falls 2 weeks ago, crossed the road in front of me. It was icy. I was going slow. It did not run away fast or anything, just prancing across the road. Stopped, looked at the tracks. Obvious cat.
Oh, so there's nice another one, Scott.
Yep, there's another one. And the interesting thing is in these reports we've had of cougars in the past, if enough sightings are reported or enough trail camera pictures or tracks or whatever, it often proves to be an animal that's moving through the area. And if you track the dates of these sightings, you can usually get a pretty good picture of its movement as it moves through Wisconsin and perhaps out of the state. I remember that's what happened with the one that was in southern Wisconsin, and I think was ultimately shot by police in Chicago. But anyway, they can cover a lot of ground. Since we've got Park Falls involved here, I might make note of the fact that some of my friends up in Price County, where we have a cabin, have been sending reports of three different moose that have been seen in that area, too, not far east of Park Falls. So if anybody has recent sighting of those animals, that's kind of curious as well. They've been up around Highway 182 and Fifield and between Park Falls and Manitowish. So
very cool.
Some other cool animals to see up there that you don't see very often.
Thanks, David. John emailed a question about chipmunks. He's a big fan of them. Learned about a lot about their seasonal patterns after moving to Cornucopia way up north a couple of years ago. Most of the chipmunks have already gone into torpor around mid to late November, save for one. She's a young chipmunk, most likely born this year, and started showing herself daily a week ago, trying to climb through the several inches of snow that they've gotten so far, foraging for food. John thinks she's abandoned the burrow she built during the summer fall months for some reason, is feverishly working to set up another. The frost line here is only a couple of inches down, so here's hoping it's not too late for her. Other than leaving out some high-calorie victuals for her, almonds and sunflower seed kernels mostly, is there anything else John can do to help increase her chance of survival?
Probably not, Larry, and there's a couple issues here. One is that just as a general observation, all these behavioral things we might talk about, like migration or hibernation or denning up, it's all a continuum from some early adopters to, like this chipmunk, a late kind of missed the boat type, and everybody else is sort of in the middle in terms of when these events happen. Some birds clear out very early, of the same species. Some are here until the bitter end. I had a red-winged blackbird at my feeder a week or so ago, and I'm thinking, holy cow, what are you still doing here? You know, all your thousands of friends left 2 months ago. So it's kind of a bell curve, and there's always a few individuals out on the extremes at both ends, either early or late. And sometimes there are physiological explanations, parasites, or you know they've got some injury or whatever that's changed their behavior. But sometimes they're just late. And if he's putting out some food, that's fine, as long as that doesn't encourage the animal to remain active in moderate weather. And then all of a sudden we get a real Arctic blast or one of these polar vortices. I can hardly wait until the weather people start talking about that again. You know, then that chipmunk might be in big trouble very quickly. But there's probably not much intervention necessary here. The hardline approach is that for most of these smaller species, they're incredibly abundant, as are chipmunks, and some make it through the winter and some don't. Winter's the bottleneck for most Wisconsin species as far as survival, and you'll just have to see how it plays out for that individual.
Let's take a call from Alex in Galena. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Larry. We're right on the Wisconsin state line, and I saw two different individual cougars over the course of this summer. I'm kind of well-versed in animals, so I know they were two different ones. Their territory seemed to be about 8 to 10 miles apart. Saw them the first time was back in late April, early May. The larger one I saw again maybe a month later, and then another week after that. And the smaller one I saw twice, once out by the waterfall and again over near the horse farm. So, definitely cougars, grew up with them.
Wow, well, there's Galena, Illinois, right on the border, Scott. And Nancy, by the way, sent us a picture from a trail cam in Winneconne, wondering if it was a cougar. Kind of looks like one.
Is that something you emailed me, Larry?
Yeah, I don't know if you may not have gotten it yet.
Well, I'm checking. Let's see.
But Alex and Galena, the two cougars, could have been the same one perhaps, but it sounds like Alex thinks it was two different ones.
Well, this trail camera picture that I was just sent is actually from Winneconne.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's there's no question about what it is. That's a really good picture of a good-sized cougar. But as far as the ones down by Galena, you know, that's an area where I would expect them to do well. There are plenty of sightings in Iowa and Minnesota, neither of which are too far from that area. And it's in the driftless area where there's plenty of deer, plenty of shelter in the form of rock outcrops and whatnot. So good place. Maybe they'll hang around there. So as I expected, once we rip the Band-Aid off this cougar thing, Larry, we're going to hear about lots of them.
Yeah, for sure. Well, here's one from Gene in Beaver Dam.
Hi.
Hi, Gene.
Yeah, yes, we had a cougar on our trail cam. We live on the edge of Beaver Dam. We have about an acre, lots of woods, a little creek going through. And, it was the middle of the day, and it was right there in broad daylight.
Yeah. So Beaver Dam.
Well, we're filling in the blank spots around the state, Larry. I should have gotten a Wisconsin map and started putting dots on as these surveys came in. But I think the DNR is trying to track this, too. I know if there's trail camera photos involved that people are sending in, they certainly are. So this is one of those things where people can help wildlife managers and researchers in terms of tracking these animals. The formal way is through the trail camera project the DNR is running. But as people see something they think is unusual, then they can help a lot by calling it in. One of the things I wanted to mention a little bit later, I'll just bring it up now, is that the DNR has a call out and the researchers have a call out that anyone in the state who finds a black bear den is asked to report that to their local DNR wildlife biologist to help out with a study on black bear reproduction. And ultimately, they're putting radio collars on sows that they find in these dens. And their goal over the next few years of research is to collar 100 sows, and they really need the public's help to locate these dens so they can do the research. So here's another way that people can help out if they're interested in wildlife, and most people are, and want to do something beneficial. Find those bear dens and tell your local wildlife biologist where they are.
Let's take a call from Jeff in Superior next. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Good morning, gentlemen. Happy holidays to you and yours.
To you as well.
Thank you. I drive the corridor between Superior and Ashland quite often, and I've noticed, I guess it's pronounced to me because I haven't noticed it normally, that when the snow comes and they plow, it must push the dead deer carcasses underneath a snowbank or something, because the eagles are, it's like a parade on Highway 2. They're every other tree. I saw probably about a dozen yesterday, and I know they're overlooking the highway and looking for rodents or, you know, anything they can eat, but it just seems like they gather around the highways more lately. Is that a normal thing?
Well, it is, and, you know, driving down any road in Wisconsin now, depending on where you are, you'll see any one of a number of things. In the North Woods, you see the ravens flying along the road corridors. Further south, see the vultures flying along the road corridors. The eagles are always looking around on the roads. They're exquisite scavengers, and a deer carcass is a pretty good meal. So this is just adaptive behavior on the part of a number of bird species that have, and not only bird species, I'm sure that wolves, coyotes, and other scavengers or are patrolling the roads on foot, probably under cover of darkness. But certainly the birds are more visible, and, hey, it's a good source of easy food.
Mm. Mike in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I don't think anyone's mentioned it, but just a few years ago, the local news in Milwaukee had video from somebody's front porch security camera that was clearly showed a full-grown puma sniffing around, and it was on the local news in Milwaukee.
Hmm.
Well, there's another dot on the map, Larry. And I had forgotten about the ring cameras and security cameras. My neighbor across the street sends me a ring video probably every other day with a nice buck or some deer or whatever moving through his backyard that are captured on the ring camera. So there are lots of sources of information that we just never had available to us 10 or 20 years ago in terms of knowing where these animals were and what they were doing.
Yeah. Randy in New Richmond, your turn. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Great show. In the early 2000s, I came face-to-face on a fishing expedition just barely over the border into Canada from Wisconsin with a North American gray puma, 250-pound female. She was still nesting, so to speak. Her belly was hanging low, and her nipples were out. She was clearly feeding, and this thing came in 6 a.m. And kind of checked us out and then took off. So we got a hold of Canadian authorities. They tracked it, confirmed it, and ordered us out of the area as soon as our permit expired, because they were going to find it and do something about it. They were very, very shook by that.
Mm.
I was wondering if you've ever seen one.
Have not.
No, nor have I.
Interesting encounters.
Yeah, they sure are. Randy, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too. We've got a question for Scott. I hope you will join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. And if you've got a photo you want to send, by all means, do send it to ideas@WPR.org. Let's take a look at the deer hunt this year. The DNR says hunters killed about 14% more deer during this year's season. How does the amount of deer hunters kill each year affect the overall population, Scott?
Well, in general, it was a very good season. The weather was favorable. There was light snow cover virtually everywhere. I was speaking from experience. It was mighty darn cold on opening morning.
Yes, it was.
In the southwestern part of the state, and I think most of the state, with not only cold temperatures but brutal winds. But you're right. Overall, the harvest was up. The total firearm harvest was up 14.4%. Antlered up 14.7%, and antlerless just a little bit behind that. So this is gun only at just over 200,000. When the total summary comes in after all the other seasons are way in on this, the archery season in particular and the crossbow harvest, you know, the harvest should certainly exceed 300,000. Not a record by any means, but up from previous years. And most of the reports I heard, people were pretty happy with the way things went, and some camps did very well. I heard of one camp up in northern Wisconsin in the winter area that didn't see very much, but it's kind of typical of that particular group. Sorry, Larry, that was just a little jab at your operation. But overall, things were pretty good. The Central Forest saw the most increase. Even the Northern Forest, where you hunt, Larry, was up almost 20%. Yeah. So that suggests that the deer herd was in good health. The problem, of course, if you want to call it a problem, is that back with the implementation of the Deer Trustees Report back in 2012, the DNR, one of the directives from that was that the DNR was not going to issue herd size estimates before or after the season, and this rather fell to the individual counties, which became the management units rather than the numerical units we used to have. And as a result, you can't look at a graph and see that the DNR may be maintaining some information like this, but is generally not in the hands of the public. But you can't look and say, well, we had 1.8 million last year, and this outstanding harvest brought it down to 1.6 million or whatever. We just don't do that anymore for reasons that were outlined in that Deer Trustees report. But a harvest of this magnitude is essential to keeping a lid on the deer population. And as you know, there are a wide variety of problems, especially in central and southern Wisconsin, associated with a burgeoning deer herd, from deer vehicle collisions to agricultural losses, forestry concerns, and so forth. And that's the nature for the various interest groups who are represented on the county Citizens Deer Advisory Councils, who make the recommendations for a given county that the herd should be increased, decreased, or some stability should be maintained. So, excuse me. The harvest is very important in terms of the overall deer management strategy, and it's really, these days, the major deer management strategy that we have, since there's relatively little done in terms of habitat manipulation other than by private landowners or really anything else.
Let's take another call. Dave in Eagle River, on to you now. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Larry. So I wanted to tell you about my moose sighting. It was probably right before Thanksgiving, maybe a week before Thanksgiving. I was raking leaves on my driveway, and all of a sudden I looked up, and you know, that you don't see a moose very often in Wisconsin, but I looked up, the moose saw me. And I saw the moose, and he kind of stopped, or I should say she, because she had a cow with her. And we kind of looked at each other for a minute, and I went, wow, that's really cool, a moose. And then all of a sudden, a few of the neighbors had seen the moose also. And they started they started advancing, I'm going to say, if not running, towards the moose with their cell phones up. So, and I am I'm located, I don't know if you're familiar with the Eagle River area.
Yeah.
But I'm located on the south end of Cranberry Lake.
There you go.
Excellent. Well, we'll this is proving very useful, Larry. We've got a map going with cougar dots, and now we can start a moose map.
There we go. Dave, thanks a lot for calling. Yes, it's got to be a great experience. Oh, I would love to see a moose in the
See, Larry,
wild.
If we can go back to the deer hunt for just a moment, there were a couple of other, I think, interesting points about the harvest. The one that I found interesting, and I always do, license sales are obviously being paid close attention to because of the issue of declining hunter numbers and those kinds of things. So license sales were down 1.6% from the same time last year. This was for gun privileges, but some of this is being offset by hunters shifting to crossbows and other means of harvesting deer. So it's become very muddy water in terms of interpreting what our hunter number situation is like. But the thing that I marvel at every year is that licenses were sold to hunters from all 50 states and Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico, and also hunters came from 21 different countries to hunt deer in Wisconsin.
Amazing.
So every state and 21 different countries, and a group of, between how you, depending on how you count the numbers, you know, somewhere north or south of 600,000 people. It's a big deal. And a lot of deer were taken, to be sure, but there are a lot of people who go home without a deer as well. So it's not a sure thing by any means. And, of course, CWD is still a problem. I'm, like many people, I'm still sitting here waiting for my test results to see whether the deer I have processed and in the freezer is going to be consumable or not. And we'll see how that plays out. But you know, overall, it was a very good season. And I should point out that the season is not over by any means. I think today's the 7th. I think the 4-day doe hunt starts tomorrow. Let me just check. Yes, it does. 4-day antlerless season, December 8th to the 11th. So that starts tomorrow. The muzzleloader season ends today. And then there's the 9-day antlerless only holiday hunt in some of the southern farmland zone counties that goes the day before Christmas to New Year's Day. And the archery seasons run through January 8th in most places, and extended seasons run through the end of January. So, yes, a lot of deer have been taken. A lot of people have been out in the woods, but there's still nearly a month and a half worth of opportunity for people who want to continue hunting or are still looking for deer. So it's a big deal by all measures.
Mike in Elroy has a deer-related comment. Let's go there. Mike, hi.
Yeah, I had a question. I saw a small buck on my game camera, and he had a definite collar on, and I didn't know that. I assumed it was a DNR that had collared him, and then it brought the question to mind is, what would protocol be if we harvested a deer with a collar?
Perfectly legal, and for the research groups like the Southwestern Deer Mortality Study, I mean, hunter harvest is a part of the equation that they're assessing. So I don't know exactly how the collars are identified, but I suspect there's something on there by way of a tag, label, or identification that says, if you harvest or find this deer dead on the road, however you come by the collar, please report it to so-and-so or at least your local wildlife manager, and then the information gets back to the people who collared it. So, but it's perfectly legal, just like shooting a duck with a leg band or a goose with a neck collar or a deer with a radio collar. You know, in most cases, hunters who harvest one of these study animals don't really know that it's marked before they fire the shot. And then it's just a matter of putting that in the database, and it's useful information. So no problem.
There you go, Mike. Thank you so much. Scott Craven, our guest, emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Join in with your own question or observation at 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Ann emailed us from Madison. For 2 years in a row, they've had a pair of red-tailed hawks hatch babies in their backyard pine tree. They live near the arboretum. Years one and two, they had three babies. They're so curious about their behavior once they learned to fly. Both years, the hatchlings stayed in their area, often on roofs, fences, cars, power poles, yakking away at each other and flying here and there. Initially, they see the parents bringing food to them in the nest, but then they see them hunt and eat. But why do they stay around, and how far do they go once they leave?
That's the question about their behavior, Larry?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, again, there's a lot of variability in that, but generally a lot of these young animals stay around either near their parents or with their parents until there's either another reproductive cycle or there's some big event like the fall shuffle of species as some are moving out. And our red tails generally, a few hang around, but they'll shift south, and they're often replaced by rough-legged hawks or other species from the north in terms of that niche. So they move out, and then presumably come spring as they're returning to nest sites, that pair that they've had for quite some time, if they survive the winter, would likely return to that pine tree, and the offspring will be somewhere in the general area setting up housekeeping on their own.
Mike in the UP of Michigan has something for us. Let's go there. Mike, hello.
Hello, and I enjoy your show. I'm going to tell you something about a more serious note. I'm 73 years old. I got a deer camp down in Vernon County, which, of course, is great deer hunting. But what's sad for me to see today is our wildlife science going awry to the point where they're looking for money from the general fund. Doesn't seem like hunting and trapping is that important anymore. Traditional camps in northern Wisconsin, you can't put a rosy picture on it. They're just gone, or they're not coming back. Why don't they manage the wolves like they manage any other animal? I don't understand it. And it's just sad to me because it's the same. When I grew up, the DNR, these guys, Keith McCaffrey, and my God, they lived, eat, and breathe deer hunting. These guys were on it. And today, it's almost like hunting is an annoyance. At least that's the perception I get. So,
comment on that, Scott? It would be a good chance to talk about the wolf management program.
That's a very interesting comment, but I'll just offer some observations that I don't think that the attention to hunting has necessarily faded. Deer hunting in particular, which garners the most attention, especially this time of year, has changed a great deal in the way people participate. In the area that I hunt in southwestern Wisconsin, when not too many decades ago, it sounded like World War III out there on the opening morning, just a constant barrage of gunfire. Now I hunt in that area, and I'm wondering, is this the right Saturday? Did I hunt a week too early? Because there are relatively few gunshots, nowhere near the traffic on the road, and you just don't see many hunters moving through the woods. But hunters have shifted geographically. I think some people have given up on the Southwest because of the prevalence of chronic wasting disease. Sadly, I'm on the verge of doing the same thing. Deer drives, although there are still a few, some people still participate in that activity. It's nowhere near as prevalent as it once was. Hunters have gone to sitting in muddy blinds and elevated stands and just staying put, waiting for a deer to come to them. Food plots are very important. Some of the traditional camps in the North Woods, because of lower deer densities and perceived problems with wolves, as you've seen in your own camp, Larry, it's sometimes hard to maintain some of those camps. The camp that I was part of in southwestern Wisconsin 12 of us completely disappeared within 3 years after the discovery of CWD. You know, some people just left. Some people quit hunting. So there are lots of factors that go into that observation. But hunting and hunting-related revenues from tag and license sales, from PR money coming from the excise taxes, still on average provides about 60% of a state wildlife agency's budget. However, there are new things coming online. In fact, one of the things I wanted to mention is that people who are concerned about wildlife in general, not necessarily hunting, but I'm sure hunters are very supportive of this as well, is to do whatever anybody can do right now to get their voice heard by their members of Congress to try and complete passage of the Recovering America's Wildlife Act, known as RAWA, R-A-W-A, before the end of the session at the end of the year. That's going to provide, if it's passed, a huge chunk of money to augment funding by state agencies. And because it's coming from a different source, remove some of the emphasis that a lot of people perceive has been in agencies when most of their money came from hunting interests. So this will be used, this money, if it becomes available, will be used to support wildlife in a broad sense. And some initiatives in many states referred to as the Relevancy Project, where they're working to broaden the support base for wildlife conservation in any given state beyond the hunting community. That's not to say we don't have broad-based support already in Wisconsin, but that may not be the case in some states. Anyway, this is a big chunk of money, a very important federal legislation if we can get it passed, and it will change the playing field a little bit, but in the long run, be good for all wildlife. The caller, I guess it was Mike, is correct, though, that agencies have begun to shift a little bit from the emphasis on hunting and may not have the staff that they once had to focus on deer and deer hunting like Keith did, whom he mentioned. But that doesn't mean that they disregard it in any way. They're still very active in spending a lot of money on recruitment, retention, and reactivation programs to keep hunter numbers up and to bring new, younger people into the field who are motivated by other things like, you know, the availability of good, high-quality wild game meat and so forth, rather than some of the other motivations that may be fading from the past. So I don't think there are some interesting observations and changes, Mike, but I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. And if this RAWA Act gets passed, it's going to be a lot more money to do a lot of good things for wildlife in general. So Mike, there you have it.
Yeah, Mike, thank you so much. And we might as well mention the Wolf Management Plan, Scott, because that's just been announced.
Yes, and I'm glad we're bringing it up with only 2 minutes to go before the top of the hour, because we'll get a breather. Yes, you're right. The long-awaited and much-needed wolf management plan that's been worked on for quite a few years was released not too long ago, and it's out now for review. It's a bit contentious because the plan backs away from what was a central tenet of the old plan, which was a population goal of 350 that was put in place in 1999. Now the new plan does not call for any numerical objective. And that numerical objective, as you well know, Larry, was the flashpoint for, holy cow, there's too many. There's not enough. We need hunting. We don't need hunting. All because of where the population stood in relation to the 350. The current estimate, I think, the DNR released along the plan for right now is about 970 animals. But they're proposing to go to a situation where they look at each of the six zones in the state individually and make the same kind of decisions that the county CDACs, or Citizen Deer Advisory Committees, make with regard to deer. And that is the wolf population in this zone, does it need to go up? Does it need to go down? Or should we strive for stability? And then management will proceed in terms of future hunting, which is a moot point because they're back on the endangered species list. But that's the sticking point. And then there's been a lot of concern over some mechanics of how the plan is being reviewed. There are no public hearings being held, which has aggravated some people. There's what some people are claiming is a short comment period of only 60 days as opposed to 90, and it comes over the holidays when everybody's busy. And it's also very difficult to, well, maybe not necessarily difficult, but a little different for people to make comments. In other words, they have to go to the website and go through a survey that's institutionalized on the website, as opposed to, you know, phone calls or written comments, which are not being accepted. So anyway, the plan is out there for review. Ultimately, it will be in the hands of the NRB, the Natural Resources Board, and the legislature. But for now, at least there's a plan out there for people to react to. So we'll see what happens.
See what happens. Scott Craven, our guest today, emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. He will be with us right up until 12:30 today. And you can join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a photo you want to send, please email it to us. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Scott. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining in today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, Extension Emeritus Wildlife Ecologist at UW. So, wildlife questions on your mind? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call from Dennis in Two Rivers. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I was just thinking, since, I heard chimney swifts are on the decline because their habitat is on decline, but I wonder, well, with these TV antennas that are pretty much built on tripods with open space in between, how likely is it somebody could put some kind of a tube in the middle in that open space that chimney swifts might want? I know sometimes somebody thinks, well, this creature is in danger or whatever, then they're found somewhere else. And I suppose as a related thing, how do we know if there's only one Taylor Swift? Okay, hang up and listen.
Well, we've got Taylor Swift and we got chimney swifts. Let's take the chimney swift.
Well, chimney swifts have been having some problems, Larry, and there were, I think we mentioned on a program a few months ago, or at least I was going to, that there was a call out, much like there was the call we talked about earlier about finding bear dens. There was a call out to identify chimneys or towers that were still being used by swifts. And there are ways to make artificial structures that are attractive to them. Whether there'd be any interest in, you know, modifying the repeater towers or cell phone towers or whatever else, I don't know. That might be a maintenance issue or something else. But it's a very interesting idea, and I made a note of it. I'll try and mention it to some of the bird folks I know. But if Dennis is really keen on this, you have to call his local DNR office and get that in the mill as far as the DNR's natural heritage inventory and the folks who are actually working on swifts, or call the Audubon Society folks in his area or anybody else he can think of, and this will become known as the Dennis plan. And it's actually an intriguing idea.
Yeah, it is.
So anyway, thanks, Dennis, and happy holidays.
Robert emailed us and wonders your comment on what you would like to see in a new DNR secretary appointment.
What I would like to see?
Yeah.
Oh, very interesting. Well, I would like to see, here's a couple of things that come to mind. This is not something I've thought much about, but number one, I'd like to see someone appointed without consideration of political affiliation. I'd like to see someone appointed who is an active user of the outdoors, whether it's hiking, biking, canoeing, kayaking, hunting, fishing, trapping. I don't care. Just someone who's very active in the outdoors. And number three, someone with some, well connected within the economic community in Wisconsin, but also someone who hopefully has either some work experience or educational experience in natural resources. So some experience, some personal interest, try and get the politics out of it as much as we can, and move forward with that.
I think those are all good suggestions. Let's take a call from Christina in Glenwood City. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I live in Western Wisconsin on a 50-acre farm, and I love and I feed the birds. In April and May, when the robins and the bluebirds come in, we often get a bad snowstorm or ice storm. And by then, the berries and the apples are gone from the shrubs and the trees, which limits their food source. So I'm wondering, what can I keep on hand to help them at this challenging time?
Well, interesting. So you mentioned robins and bluebirds in particular. And if you visit one of the bird feeding stores, and I'm thinking, beyond the I shouldn't say beyond the feed mill or other supply places, because some of these, the one I go to get corn and whatnot, has a wide variety of different feed mixes. But there are some of the seed companies that make a mix that they call berry blend, or may have other names of it, that have fruit materials in it as at least one component, and they bill it as being something that's useful in the spring when those fruit sources are largely gone. But fruit-eating birds, robins in particular, will utilize them. So there are some seed mixes you could have on hand. They tend to be a little more expensive, although all seed seems to be fairly expensive right now. But you could have a bag of that on hand. Some people in the bird stores or places like Wild Birds Unlimited and all make available mealworms, which can also be put out, and those are attractive to the bluebirds as well. So that's a specialty stores that supply bird feeding materials. You can find either seed mixes or insect mixes focusing on mealworms or perhaps other products that you could put out in emergency situations like this. You could also, if you're caught blind on this, use some household things and at least give it a try. Some raisins, some chopped apple, things like that that the birds may find, if it's a desperate situation, may find attractive. So
there you go.
Good thing to think about. I enjoy just thinking about the fact that spring is coming and that these birds may be back. So a good thought, Christine.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. Fern in Sheldon, Wisconsin, we go to you now. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yes, I'm just wondering if it bothers anyone like it does me to think of these small children out in the woods hunting. And I'm especially referencing the October 7th copy of Wisconsin Outdoor News, which has an adorable-looking little girl, 6 years old, with her 9-point buck that she got with a crossbow. And then that wasn't enough. Inside the paper, there is the same little girl with a 252-pound black bear that she also got with her crossbow. Now, I do not understand the need to get these small children involved so young in hunting.
So what do you think, Scott? 6 years old seems young to me.
Well, back when they eliminated the age limitations, I got a little anxious about that, because I understand that some folks want to get their kids involved in this as quickly as they can. And there initially was a lot of effort in this recruitment or R3 program I mentioned earlier to work with kids, although that's now shifted, I think, to slightly older demographics. Kids in families with a strong hunting heritage are likely going to hunt anyway. At least the research would show that that's an increased probability, as opposed to a young kid raised in a family that has no hunting heritage. They have a difficult time breaking in and may have to wait until they're kind of on their own later in life. I was a little concerned initially that, you know, having 5 or 6 year olds out in the woods with guns was an issue, but fortunately there have not been any problematic incidents in that regard. But this is a tough one, Larry. I mean, I've been out on the youth hunt for deer that the caller was alluding to with my two grandsons who are here in the Madison area, although they were 11 and 12 at the time. And I was with them in a blind when they both shot their first bucks. And, you know, it was a fantastic experience. It was pretty cool. Those boys were probably going to get involved with hunting no matter what, but at least I was able to get involved in the early stages of it. The thing that bothers me a little bit more about some of these young kids, and I'm not a youth psychologist or a social scientist, but I wonder about, you know, picture of the little girl she mentioned with a great big buck that, you know, people don't get that many great big bucks in their career of hunting, as you and I well know, Larry. Yeah. And I wonder about not the gun safety issue. Some people are concerned about that, but I think that can be dealt with. But I wonder about giving these kids the idea that, hey, you know, we hunt in October when it's 65 degrees and beautiful fall colors and the deer don't know what's going on yet and so forth. And holy cow, I can shoot whatever I want and I get a great big buck. You know, I worry about what they have to look forward to. if they've essentially, in some cases, killed the biggest buck they may ever kill in a lifetime of hunting, you know, I wonder what that does. And then I guess I would like to think that somebody's looking at these kids when they become or turn 17 and all of a sudden, oh, can't hunt in October anymore. Mm-hmm. Got to wait for the opening day in November and it's 14 degrees and a strong wind and there's 600,000 other people out there. You know, I wonder if that really has any impact on their future participation. I don't know. But much like the caller, I've been concerned about some of those things for a long time. But on the other hand, I feel a little hypocritical in that I've taken advantage of the situation and been out with my grandkids and have two younger grandkids in Colorado now who want to come out here for the youth hunt and participate. And if that gets them involved in a lifetime of hunting, which has been very good to me and very good for me, then so be it. But there are some deeper implications here that I just wonder if anybody's paying any attention to whether they are important or whether they aren't.
Yeah, some good thoughts. Fern, thank you very much for bringing that up. I appreciate it. Let's take a call from Jan in Middleton. Jan, hello.
Hi there. I noticed, Larry, that you were answering about the woman that was asking what to feed the robins and the bluebirds when there's a snow and there's no natural food out there. I am part of one of those stores that you have given seminars at, Larry, and some of the things that we have discovered about feeding bluebirds or robins in this situation is that you can scramble some eggs and chop it up really well and disperse it over the top of the snow. The birds not only need the fruit, but they also need the protein. The other thing is when you want to feed them, if you have some leftover grapes or raisins, please make sure you soak them so that they are soft enough and chop them into very small pieces so that it doesn't get stuck in the bird's beak or as they try to swallow it, it has to be really small. And so that way they they will be able to eat, and you can spread it out more also on the snow. But those are things that we have learned over the course of the years of having a business that caters to birds and outdoor wildlife. And also the statement that you made about mealworms is very important. And there are opportunities to get live mealworms at some places where you can get fishing information and bait like that, or in a dry situation, for instance, in a store like ours. So that's all I wanted to say, just because I want to give the best information that everybody can use. And yes, scrambled eggs do work a little bit, both people and birds.
Jan? Jan, thank you so much for calling. Comments, Scott?
Yeah, I think that there were some good points there, and certainly the raisins and grapes and so forth, you should chop them up a bit. The other source for things like mealworms and even crickets and some other things you wouldn't think would be available in the winter is many pet shops carry those because they're widely used in the captive reptile and amphibian. People who have these animals as pets need the mealworms and crickets and so forth to feed them through the winter. So that's another source. The scrambled egg thing distributed on the snow, I think, ought to be used with a little caution, because you start throwing products like that out on the snow, yes, it may benefit the birds, but it's also going to attract skunks, possums, raccoons, potentially a number of rodents and things you may not want around your house. So I think that needs to be used with a little caution, but certainly may help. Spreading those kinds of things in a shelf feeder or on a deck railing or something, you know, may target the birds a little better than just widely distributing it, where it may attract everything from feral cats to raccoons that you just don't want in the yard.
Yeah.
And it might be detrimental to the birds in another way. So, and Larry, as we wind down here, let's get the Christmas stuff in if we can.
Let's do that. Have you got some good ideas for holiday gifts?
No, I'm absolutely at a loss. I've got nothing, Larry. Actually, I do have a few ideas here, but one idea is a tip I just wanted to be sure to get out, and that is December 10th, coming up on Saturday, is a big day for would-be turkey or bear hunters. The permit applications and so forth are all due on the 10th, which is coming up very quickly, so don't miss that. Okay, Christmas ideas. Starting with a really easy one that the DNR has provided, you can get 5 issues of the DNR magazine, which is a really nice magazine. They're offering a deal now where you can get new subscriptions, renewals, and gift subscriptions until the day after Christmas for only $5. Pretty good deal.
That's a good deal.
A lot of useful information. And on a similar note, Outdoor News, the Wisconsin edition, which is biweekly in a newspaper format, is also a great source of information in all things outdoors. Item number 2, since we were just talking about bird feeding, you know, you go to some of the big bird feeding or outdoor stores or some of the feed mills and so forth. There are all sorts of feeders, supplies, and other related equipment available that make wonderful gifts. And don't forget the seed itself. You know, black oil sunflower, which has been the standard for feeding for quite some time now, has gotten pretty expensive. I've been seeing it. I used to think $20 a bag was a good price. Now $40 is more the standard. So especially for people who are older or don't get out well in the winter, you know, think about if they like to feed birds, get them a big 50-pound bag of bird seed, bring it to the house, and they'll be set to go for a while, and that's just a nice, thoughtful gift for people who enjoy bird feeding. From the standpoint of just wildlife appreciation, boy, I don't think you can beat field guides. Whether it's the Peterson Field Guide series, the Audubon guides, the Stokes guides, there are many of them. They're all good, but you know, everybody should have a standard set of field guides around the house so that they can identify what they're seeing. Optics for observation. you know, they come in a wide range, a wide price range. Do your homework on what you need and what you want and find the right optics. And that also makes wonderful gifts. Wildlife-related art, bird feeders and supplies, as I just mentioned, and lots of wildlife-related magazines like National Wildlife Federation or Audubon. For outdoor participants, you know, a fishing lure makes a great stocking stuffer. You know, you and I both fish a lot, Larry, and we well know that you can a musky plug these days can get up to $25 or $30.
Yep.
And even some standard lures that used to be a couple dollars are quite a bit more. Some are made right here in Wisconsin. You know, go to the Wisconsin companies, and fishing lures or sets of them are a nice and easy gift. I think memberships in some of our conservation organizations are a great idea. Trout Unlimited, Whitetails Unlimited, the Wild Turkey Federation, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Pheasants Forever, Rough Grouse Society, Ducks Unlimited. There are many more. And giving somebody a gift membership usually gets them a group magazine, all sorts of correspondence, and easy access to their entertaining fundraising banquets that they hold throughout the year. So that's another possibility.
One that I enjoy, and I'm actually giving a few of them this year, is a state park sticker.
Yeah, that's another really good one. And that, you know, to the extent that you use it, it's a ticket to many interesting things. So by the same token, you know, giving a license, a fishing license, a hunting license, or a gift certificate, or the money to get that license, because it's hard to buy it for somebody else. But, you know, that's a nice thing, too, along with the park sticker. Or give them a patron's license, and then the park sticker's included. let's see. So the licenses, what else have I got here? Oh, electronics and gadgetry. You know, it's pretty amazing what's available now for fishing electronics, for navigation, online apps like Onyx that I use that keep a hunter or a hiker or whatever you're doing outside. You know exactly where you are. You know what the land ownership is where you are. You know, all those make great gifts. There are alert systems. My son was given one. It's a satellite system. It's a little gadget he can wear with him when he's out in Colorado in the big backcountry, that if you run into problems, you know, you trip and break an ankle or something, this device, it's essentially an emergency GPS that he can broadcast his location with and get help.
Well, we are running out of time here, Scott, but you have given us a broad range of gift ideas, and of course we had some great conversation as well throughout the program. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. And, well, if not before, we'll see you next year.
I'll see you in February, and happy holidays to everybody coming up here.
Thanks, Scott. Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. He'll be back in February, the first Wednesday of February, and we will do this all over again. Of course, Jamie Knack and David Drake will be here the first Wednesday of January. Well, tomorrow, our home improvement expert's back to talk about asbestos removal, among other things. That's tomorrow at 11. But in the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.